here with us for the morning show as we check in on Wisconsin port activity. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The pandemic caused a reduction in freighter activity in the shipping season. The Port of Green Bay has published new numbers. Its cargo tonnage in and out of the port in 2020 dropped about 15% compared to the previous year. Coal used to be the port's largest import, but for the first time in decades, coal volume was less than 200,000 pounds. What questions do you have about port activity in your part of Wisconsin? Are you near the Twin Ports or Port Milwaukee? What do you want to know about import exports and harbor cleanups? 800-642-1234 to join in. Thomas Dakin is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel covering commercial development. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you, Kate. Happy to be here.
And Megan Hart is here as well, WPR sports reporter based in Green Bay, but she's been covering our state's commercial freight ports, specifically the challenges around climate change. Megan, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, Megan, let's start with you where you are in Green Bay. What is the Port of Green Bay experiencing in the pandemic?
Well, as you said, the Port of Green Bay has experienced a total cargo reduction of about 15% this year. Usually their goal is about 2 million tons, and they didn't quite hit that. But they do say it was a better year, actually, than 2016 and 2017. So you can kind of see how much they've grown in recent years.
So the pandemic not really eating into the operations there.
Well, you know, it. I think it kind of is the story changed throughout the year. I know, for example, at the Port of Duluth Superior, things picked up in the second half of the year. Early in the pandemic, I think when more businesses were shut down, it had a larger impact at ports across the state.
Tom, what are you experiencing with commercial shipping in your region at Port Milwaukee?
Well, Port Milwaukee was a bit of an anomaly last year. In 2020, the Milwaukee Harbor saw its traffic actually increase a little over 5%, and that's both the shipments handled by the municipal, the city-owned port, as well as the private docks. And that came at a time when overall in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Seaway region, you had about a little under a 2% decline. So we were bucking a trend here in Milwaukee.
What was behind that?
Well, in part, exports of grain, exports of construction materials. And you mentioned in your introduction that that coal is down. I think you said up in the Green Bay port. I believe that's probably the case.
Yeah.
Probably every port in the Great Lakes, because coal, obviously, the demand for that has been dropping for years as it's being replaced by natural gas. For generating electricity and heating purposes and by sustainable fuels.
Megan, let's go to the top of the state here, Port of Duluth Superior. This is the largest port by tonnage on the Great Lakes. How has this port been affected with cargo shipping?
It has been affected by the pandemic. It did see a decline in total tonnage this year. Through October, it was down 29%. And that can be directly related to the pandemic. The Port of Duluth Superior is primarily a natural resources port, so it deals with a lot of raw materials. The main one is iron ore, which accounts for 55% of its tonnage. And that was down 27% through the end of October. And that had to do with some of Minnesota's iron ore mines actually closing early in the pandemic when appliance and auto manufacturers shut down. And then, as was just alluded to, that kind of led to a further decline in demand for coal because those manufacturers no longer needed as much energy. And on the Superior side of the port is the largest coal terminal on the Great Lakes, and that was closed for about 6 weeks early in the year. So overall, coal was down 45% through the end of October when compared to 2019.
If I may just interject here, I think
pretty clear coal isn't the future. I think we all know that. I think that's been established for several years. What could be the future, though, is exports, those materials that we ship outside of the United States. And in Milwaukee, the port is about to begin construction this spring on a $35 million grain export facility for a company called DeLong Company that's based in Clinton, Wisconsin. and that will be used to ship distiller's grains, which is an animal feed supplement to customers throughout the world. And I'm just going to mention that in light of the change in presidents that we just had, that, you know, maybe not fighting trade wars with our allies is a good thing for people in Wisconsin.
The ripple effect there. Tom Dakin is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Megan Hart is a WPR reporter covering commercial freight ports in northern and eastern Wisconsin. We're looking at port activity around the state amid the pandemic. Do you live in Superior or Duluth? Have you seen the Twin Ports collaborate? What do you think makes this partnership unique? Do you live near another port? Which one? What is it like? 800-642-1234. Megan, you mentioned there with the Twin Ports commodities being quite tamped down in 2020. Did that impact layoffs or furloughs or operations at the Twin Ports?
Port of Duluth Superior contributes billions of dollars to the regional economy. So any difficulties that are felt there are felt throughout the region. But of course, 2020 was a really difficult year across a lot of industries. The Port Authority leases to operators for the most part, and I'm not aware of onshore layoffs, though, like I said, the coal terminal was closed for weeks. But I know Key Lakes, which is a shipping company, they did actually bench three of their ships due to decreased demand related to the pandemic, and that resulted in about 100 layoffs around July. But those were people who worked on the ships. And then I know in the second part of the year, actually, at the Port of Duluth Superior, at least, they had some cargo that was expected earlier in the year that was delayed. So their shipping schedule was changed pretty dramatically, sort of as a result of the pandemic. And so many workers there late in the year actually were working quite hard later into the year than they normally would to deal with those shipments.
Oh, that's interesting, because Port of Los Angeles, our nation's largest port, in November, it marked its best month in history due to a surge in imports, like warehouses and stores restocking after months of the pandemic. Tom, did you see any surges in the late fall at Port Milwaukee?
I must confess, I haven't been looking at the figures on a month-to-month basis. I'm a little bit late to the game of covering harbors and ports, which I've mostly got into because of their effect on commercial development.
Yeah,
I would say this, that as of late fall, the Milwaukee Harbor was already projecting that it was going to have a pretty good year, all things considered, both the pandemic's effects on the economy, as well as about a year ago, we had a terrible storm on the Great Lakes down here in the Milwaukee area that caused millions of dollars of damage to the port, and they managed to put up impressive numbers despite that as well.
Megan, the Twin Ports had a good year for wind and energy, you know, these wind turbine components, thinking about those massive fiberglass blades. What is the story with wind energy freight?
Yeah, so the Port of Duluth Superior did have a record-breaking year for wind energy freight. That goes through their general cargo terminal, which is operated by the Port Authority. The last time they broke a record, I think, was 2008, and they said they just barely broke it back then. And then they kind of smashed it this past year. They had 30 ships from 8 different countries bring in equipment to assemble 154 wind turbines in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And I asked if that was a trend that they see continuing. They said it's unlikely maybe that they'll break the record again this year, and that it really kind of comes down to where those wind farm projects are taking place. But they're hopeful that will continue to be a strong cargo in the future.
We're talking with WPR reporter Megan Hart and Tom Dakin. Tom is a business reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Megan is a WPR reporter. They've been looking at Wisconsin's commercial freight ports. Do you live near a port? Which one? What is it like? What do you see as far as cargo traffic? Do you work for the Great Lakes ports? What's your job? How has it been affected by the pandemic? Join in with what you're seeing, experiencing, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing port activity and cleanup here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Industrial pollution has plagued Milwaukee's waterways and its harbors for decades. An ambitious cleanup that could cost upwards of $400 million is underway for the city's estuary and harbor. What questions do you have about making our ports healthier and habitable for wildlife and people? What should a cleanup entail, and who is responsible? What grants or federal assistance do you want Wisconsin to pursue to clean up its harbors? 800-642-1234. We have reporters Tom Dakin from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Megan Hart from WPR, and they stay with us. Let's take a call now. John is with us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, John.
Hi. I work on an icebreaker that escorts shipping during the winter months, and one of the things I've noticed was especially during spring breakout last spring, was a sharp decline in the number of vessels we were escorting, and we knew that several of them were staying in layup longer because of business closures and because they weren't sure if their crews could stay healthy and be underway. I think that's continuing to some extent. However, the seasonal ice is still, I think, the biggest factor that affects how much shipping continues or doesn't continue on the lakes. Because at the end of the day, pandemic or no pandemic, certain industries have to keep moving or the economy doesn't.
John, do you get the sense that there is enough room for all these freighters in layup?
Is there enough space? The shipping industry on the Great Lakes has been in place for long enough that I think the infrastructure is actually growing. I know that a new shipyard opened up in Escanaba recently, and there's certainly the capacity at the shipyards for more ships to be in layup has increased, but that doesn't help the economy at all if they're sitting idle, not carrying the bulk goods that make the Great Lakes economy work.
Mm-hmm. What do the crews do when a ship is in layup?
Unfortunately for the merchant mariners, if they're not working, they're not making money. I work for the government, so my salary is
consistent
by the grace of the taxpayers. But unfortunately the men and women that work in commercial shipping don't have that luxury.
John, thank you for sharing the story and giving your sense of what you're seeing, as you do on an icebreaker. Megan, what do you see when you talk to people who are a part of the port industry and what their role is? We think of the ships, but there are so many different jobs.
I would say for a story that aired late last year, I spoke to Deb DeLuca, who's executive director of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, and Adam Tindelschlick, who's director of Port Milwaukee. And one thing that they both said, without any prompting, was that they've just been really grateful for the people who do work in the industry, because they do, like we just heard, they do keep the economy moving. They were essential workers throughout the pandemic, and they made adjustments to ensure they could continue to work. And also, they said they were impressed by how quickly the industry was able to adapt, but it's part of the nature of the industry to begin with, because there are already so many variables when you're dealing with shipping.
Tom, let's turn to the harbor cleanup now, this massive cleanup project for Milwaukee Harbor and its estuary. What is going on?
Well, the project is going to be cleaning up the harbor and portions of the Milwaukee, Menominee, and Kinnickinnick rivers that connect to the harbor. It's going to take years. It's going to cost probably upwards of $400 million, depending on what we include in that cleanup. Most of that, about $270 million, is likely going to be coming from federal taxpayers through the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And about another $100 million is coming from the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District. And Of that amount, $360 million is going to be devoted to basically removing dirty mud, taking sediment on the river bottoms and harbor bottoms that's contaminated with PCBs and lead and all sorts of nasty stuff, mostly dating back to our industrial legacy here in Milwaukee in the late 1800s, and sucking the mud out and piping it to a facility where it can be safely stored and dried and over several years eventually turned into solid ground. And of that $360 million devoted to sediment removal, a big portion of that will be spent building the facility for storing that dried muck, and that's about $95 million, half of which is going to come through a low-interest loan provided by the EPA.
So a lot of money going into this cleanup. What is the timeline?
Well, that's really not known. It's going to take several years. I know the Lower Fox River up in Megan's neck of the woods recently finished a cleanup that took, I think, nearly 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know that it's going to be quite that long down here in the Milwaukee Harbor, but that sediment facility is going to be built over a course of about 2 years, starting probably at the end of this year. And we can't begin piping and storing the crap until we get that facility completed. So you've got that timeline. Once the facility is completed, you're probably pumping that stuff out for at least a couple more, 2 or 3 years. And in addition to that, you've got various projects that involve wetland restoration, habitat restoration that are tied to the various rivers that empty into the harbor. That's all designed to help clean things up and provide better wildlife and fish habitats.
We're talking with Tom Dakin, who is a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Megan Hart is here, WPR reporter based in Green Bay. We're looking at cargo activity, harbor cleanup at our state ports. You can join in 800-642-1234. Megan, take us to Green Bay with the coal piles. What is the status of these coal piles as Green Bay tries to clean up its riverfront?
Well, Brown County is in talks with Wisconsin Public Service to purchase a 40-acre portion of the Pulliam Power Plant right on the edge of the Fox River here in Green Bay. And right now, we're kind of at a holding point just at this moment. For more than a decade, it's been part of the strategic plan for the city and the county, and with help from the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, they determined that they should prioritize purchasing this land to help expand the port of Green Bay. Earlier this month, Governor Tony Evers announced a $500,000 idle sites grant to help Brown County purchase the land. That grant has to be approved by the WEDC. So the Brown County Board of Supervisors met in January with plans to sort of approve the memorandum of understanding. They decided to hold off until that grant was approved. But they're still in talks and thinking that it's more realistic than ever that they will be able to move the large coal piles from downtown Green Bay to the more industrial site.
Megan, you've been looking at how climate change is affecting our ports. What do you see?
Well, I think that the biggest thing is, as Tom mentioned, you know, Milwaukee suffered a big storm early last year that led to quite a bit of damage. So I think, you know, they will need to make infrastructure improvements. But the biggest thing is that it just makes things so much less predictable. For example, with the high water now, actually more freight can move through Wisconsin ports, but the water levels are less predictable than they would normally be. I think also the Port Milwaukee and the Duluth Seaway Port Authority, I know, are part of a green marine certification program. So, you know, not only are they feeling the effects and they're sort of locally, but they are also, you know, doing what they can to address the ways that they contribute to climate change. And as Tom also said, the actual cargo itself is changing.
Yeah, Tom, you know, are these ports incurring more risk due to our changing climate?
Well, as Megan just said, anytime you have less predictability as to the level of your water, yeah, that's going to affect things. You know, the removal of that contaminated mud, by the way, has that secondary effect of dredging material to make the shipping channels more accessible. So we do have that benefit as well. I just also wanted to add, Megan, talking about coal piles made me think of something we used to have here in Milwaukee, which was large coal piles that were no longer needed that sat on some of the harbor area. Once Wisconsin Electric switched its coal generating station here in downtown Milwaukee to gas, now those coal piles are gone, and we're building Komatsu Mining Company's new corporate campus there. So, again, people, the future isn't coal.
The transition continues. Yeah. Well, yeah. Thank you both for joining us. Tom Dakin, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Megan Hart, WPR reporter based in Green Bay. Stay with us. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The vaccine rollout has been challenging everywhere, but parts of rural Wisconsin are facing additional hurdles to getting the shots into people's arms. Rural health systems have limited resources, pharmacies are scarce, and in sparsely populated areas, the nearest healthcare provider may be an hour away. Danielle Kading reports.
Nurse practitioner Rebecca Fleming didn't feel the shot when she received the COVID-19 vaccine recently at the North Lakes Community Clinic in downtown Ashland.
There you are, ma'am. You got to be with us about 15 minutes.
Sounds good. Thank you. Yeah, it was easy.
Fleming was one of around 200 healthcare workers who got the Moderna vaccine at North Lakes' 14 clinics in rural northern Wisconsin. CEO Reba Rice says they've been lucky to get all the doses they requested so far. But she acknowledged the rollout has been anything but smooth for health officials and providers in Wisconsin.
The lack of coordination has really been a problem. And we did have a summer to think about it. But I just think this gobsmacked everybody.
The population in rural parts of the state tends to be older, which means people could be more at risk of serious complications from the coronavirus. And rural Wisconsin was already facing a shortage of healthcare resources before the pandemic. While nearly one-fifth of the state's population resides in rural communities, less than 10% of physicians practice in rural areas. Rural health departments are also stretched thin.
Our county health department, there is right now two nurses, so we really did not have the capacity to be able to offer the vaccine.
Health Officer Terry Harmala with Menominee and Shawano Counties says her department is partnering with larger healthcare systems like ThetaCare so people can get the shots. Across the state, many residents have been confused about how and where the shots will be administered. With limited staff and resources, John Ike thinks that should have been worked out sooner to fill in any gaps. He's director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health.
So we needed to figure out, well, where can these people go in every county in the state? And who would be doing the vaccinating?
Bayfield County Health Director Sarah Wartman says the vaccine is a light at the end of the tunnel for the pandemic. But in the meantime, she's worried about burnout among her 13 staff.
While we have a lot of hope and inspiration right now, it kind of was like this when COVID first happened. My staff were really resilient and gung-ho, lots of energy. But when we realized it wasn't going to be over in 2 months, it was really hard to keep going.
She adds that transportation is a real problem in rural areas, where some residents live an hour away from the nearest healthcare provider. In some parts of the state, pharmacy chains CVS and Walgreens are working to vaccinate nursing home residents under a federal partnership. But those outlets aren't everywhere.
How many CVSs do we have in Bayfield County? None. Absolutely none.
It's one of 15 counties in Wisconsin that doesn't have a chain pharmacy. Wartman is planning to vaccinate residents at a dozen sites across the county. A study by the University of Iowa's Rural Policy Research Institute found 5 counties in Wisconsin have just one pharmacy. Florence County is one of 110 rural counties nationwide that has none. The state is providing $86 million to help bring resources to local and tribal health departments. And Wisconsin's Deputy Health Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke says they're also sending mobile vaccination teams to help vaccinate in rural areas.
And for those where adding additional staff is not feasible, we'll have this additional state asset to supplement their resources.
Despite those resources, plenty of rural health officials feel the state should have been better prepared to address issues with rolling out the vaccine to all parts of the state. But Reba Rice with Northlake says now is not the time for blame.
Right now is the time to just roll up your sleeves and get people healthy.
And in rural communities, many residents are eager to roll up their sleeves for their dose of protection. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're checking in on changes to Wisconsin's food share program. According to DHS, Department of Health Services, more than 738,000 Wisconsinites are relying on this program to put food on the table. Families are having a hard time stretching a food budget. Hunger America estimates one in four households with children experienced food insecurity last year. Do you receive food share benefits? What questions do you have about the program? Are you new to food share since the pandemic? How long did it take to get help? 800-642-1234 to share. Rebecca McAtee is director of DHS's Bureau of Eligibility and Enrollment Policy, administering Wisconsin's food share program. Rebecca, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, give us the details of what is changing to the food share program and the additional assistance to families.
Sure. So there have been lots of changes to policies, basically flexibilities to policies at both a federal and state level since the COVID pandemic started. And with some of the most recent legislation that we've seen at a federal level, they're looking at kind of the long game with what's happening with the pandemic and ensuring that there is some additional funding that's going to families during this time. So one of the most recent changes that has happened, and this is with the December 27th bill that was passed at a federal level, is that there is an increase for the maximum allotment that families can receive under food share. So what this looks like is about a 15% increase in the monthly benefits that people can receive. Right now, this is a temporary benefit, so it is in effect from January through June of 2021. But we also know that there have been some conversations at a federal level about expanding this even further.
So when federal benefit levels change, how long does it take for it to kick in at the state level to make sure that the systems are up and running to be able to change the dollar amount?
So it kind of depends on where the change is coming from. For the allotments themselves and for the types of benefits that people receive on a monthly basis, we were able to get those changes into the system early in January. So people will see that immediately for their February benefits. So unfortunately, January benefits started going out on January 2nd, and we weren't able to get the changes in for January. But we did send out a supplement for individuals for January benefits, and that just went out this past weekend.
What kind of increased demand are you seeing for food assistance in the pandemic?
So we have definitely seen an increase in participation in our food share program. So around this time last year, January of 2020, we had under 600,000 people on our program. And we had been seeing a fairly steady decline in the numbers month over month for food share participation. Now, as you mentioned earlier, we are at just under 740,000 individuals, and that was as of the end of December. And we continue to see kind of a fairly consistent number of applications coming in on a weekly basis for new food share individuals. So continuing to see that growth month over month.
And last year, the state dispensed $1.3 billion, a little over that, in benefits, the total benefits in 2020. Can you put that into context for us compared to earlier years?
I think that at this point in time, I mean, generally we're looking at around $46 million on a monthly basis that is going out in benefits to individuals. And I can just say for the month of January, we were at over $70 million, and we're looking at somewhere around $90 million for the month of February.
Let's bring in Sarah now in Madison. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I'm curious. I'm not a food share person, but I work at a convenience store. And I see what's allowed and what's not allowed. Like, you can buy all the cold pop you want. You can buy Monster drinks, but you can't buy a cup of hot coffee. And you can't buy throat lozenges or something like that. I'm really curious. It feels very judgy to me. And I'm curious how that is decided by, so that people can buy food I mean, I think a cup of coffee is probably healthier than a soda. I don't know.
Sarah, thanks. Rebecca, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question and something we hear a lot of. I would say that so the program is managed at a federal level in terms of what's allowable. There has been some movement to look at the Thrifty Food Plan and potentially look at some of the underlying federal requirements. But right now, the federal government decides what things are allowable to purchase under the food share program. Understand that that is something that we get a lot of questions about.
In the pandemic, Rebecca, can you get groceries delivered to your door using your SNAP benefits?
In some situations, yes. So, again, there are some restrictions around what your EBT card or your food share benefits can be used for. But one of the things that the federal government has allowed is they had a pilot program for online purchasing that was going on across the nation. And with the pandemic, they basically opened that up a little bit more broadly than what it was originally intended for. So the pilot was with Walmart and Amazon. And Amazon works with Whole Foods. So at a national level, both of those vendors are able to provide online purchasing. And it doesn't happen for every location. So I think our website, the websites of those vendors kind of gives more information about which locations may provide those services. But members can go online, can purchase their benefits online. And the only thing that is not allowed is that we can't allow for delivery fees to be paid for by EBT, but mm-hmm. some of those vendors will allow if you purchase a certain amount of food, your delivery fee is waived. And so for those individuals, you know, they can get that delivery without having to pay anything extra, or those vendors will allow for an additional payment type for the delivery costs if those are there. The other thing that we've been trying to promote and work with our grocers, I know our Grocers Association has been very engaged in this, is looking at other opportunities to help promote safe purchasing and delivery or curbside pickup of foods. And so we did work with the Department of Administration and some other areas earlier this year to promote a program where we could get grocers to purchase wireless units that allow them to use curbside pickup and social distancing when doing any types of payments for EBT. So I know that quite a few grocers have taken up that opportunity and should be helping people provide kind of better assistance in a more safe fashion.
In a pandemic, yeah. We're discussing changes to the state's food share program to help with the strain of the pandemic and the extra safety precautions. Rebecca McAtee administers the program as director of DHS's Bureau of Eligibility and Enrollment Policy. Are you new to food share assistance? What questions do you have about how the program benefits work? Do you work or volunteer at a food pantry? What demands have you seen with families seeking boxes of food? What do you need? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Rebecca McAtee here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Rebecca McAtee. She's director of DHS's Bureau of Eligibility and Enrollment Policy, administering the food share program in our state. Food share benefits, as we've been talking about, temporarily increasing for the first half of 2021 to help ease the burden families are facing amid the pandemic, especially around hunger. Let's bring in Charles now in Fall Creek. Hi, Charles. What would you like to add?
Hi, good morning. Rebecca, I was wondering if you knew if there was enough funding in the food share program to incorporate everyone, let's say that everyone that was eligible for the food share program became enrolled. Is there enough funding to provide for all of those people?
Yeah. So the benefits on the food share program are actually all federally funded. And so the program is intended to be for all people who are eligible, that the funding is there to be able to support them. So we have not heard of anything where there isn't the funding that's available. So that shouldn't be a concern. But you know, with the increase of enrollment, that's happening at a national level. So just ensuring that at a congressional level, the amount of funding that's necessary for the program is there.
What are the thresholds for qualifying for the program?
Yeah, so in Wisconsin, we actually provide a higher level of the federal poverty level than what is required under federal law. So we go up to about 200% of the federal poverty level, but that also looks at it's a fairly complicated kind of algorithm of how the benefits are, how your poverty level is calculated, looking at deductions such as utilities, rent, other components such as that. But because we go up to 200%, the federal poverty requirement is 130%. So there are more people in Wisconsin that may be eligible because we go up to that 200% level.
What kind of requirements or validations, pay stubs, must be provided in order to get assistance?
So this is an area where we do have some additional flexibility based on some of the pandemic that's happening right now. So generally with food share, there is a requirement for an interview. We do those telephonically for the most part here in Wisconsin. But during the pandemic, we are actually allowed to waive the interview requirement as long as we have the underlying information that is necessary to verify somebody's eligibility. And so the major components of that are income and then other types of household composition. So looking at who all do you actually prepare and buy food with, and then also looking at those deductions that I mentioned. So what we try and use now is the best available information that we have available. So looking at data exchanges as much as possible. And then we do have some ability to look at other mechanisms for verification, especially in the instance where, you know, people have lost potentially their income and don't have access to pay stubs that they may have had access to because an employer is no longer in business. And so we are looking at other opportunities to try and be flexible around what we are looking at for verification.
Larry called in from Madison and couldn't stay with us. And Larry wants to know if there will be additional money or food share benefits added to Larry's EBT card as the pandemic continues. You touched earlier on those benefit increases, but could you help answer Larry's question?
Yeah. So right now there is the 15% increase. So that is an increase that people will see automatically on their cards when they get their normal issuance on a monthly basis. So that will start being seen on people's cards in February through June at this point in time. And we do have additional information going out to people with their notices of decision around kind of their benefit amounts. Mm-hmm. The other benefit amounts that people have been receiving and right now, it is tied to a state public health emergency, but there is also an availability of emergency allotments that we've been able to provide every month that we've had a state public health emergency. And that emergency allotment allows people to basically get up to the maximum allotment for their household size, no matter what kind of where they fall within the FPL for that household size. So they can get all the way up to the maximum allotment on a monthly basis.
And FPL means? What does that
federal poverty level.
Federal
Sorry.
Poverty level. Okay, yeah. That's okay. You know, as the state runs the food share program, eligibility is handed out at the county and regional level. Are there, as you look at our state, are there areas that you have concerns for that you've seen spikes in need during the pandemic?
You know, we actually have seen a pretty steady and pretty consistent kind of increase across all of our areas. So generally, we see our largest populations. Obviously, the Milwaukee area has, you know, about 30% of our overall caseload across the state. But we haven't seen anything where there's been significant spikes in some areas versus others. It's been pretty consistent across the state.
We're talking with Rebecca McAtee, who is director of the State Department of Health Services Bureau of Eligibility and Enrollment Policy. Her area of DHS runs the state's food share program. And we're talking about changes to benefits to help families in the first half of the year, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Rebecca, I want to return to children now. Some children get the bulk of their food and nutrition from their schools. Their schools, districts may still be providing food from the school during the pandemic. How are children being taken care of with their food needs in the pandemic?
Yeah, great. So there are a lot of different opportunities. And I know the schools, so a lot of our school nutrition programs are run through our DPI, working in conjunction with the schools to ensure that families are able to get, you know, meals packaged, can pick up those meals if they are learning virtually. And I know a lot of the schools are offering that to all families, regardless of income, just to help support those families. The other thing that is available that we are working through currently is that the federal government did reauthorize pandemic EBT in October. We have been waiting on some guidance from the federal government on how to implement this. We received initial guidance at the end of November, but the legislation that was passed at the end of December is actually changing some of that guidance to allow more flexibilities for states. And so we are planning on implementing this. We are working through implementation, but we don't yet have an approved plan from the federal government. So more information to come on that as we get more information from Food and Nutrition Services on how we can move forward.
Yeah, explain what that might mean for kids here in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
So what it means for our families in Wisconsin is that for families that have children who would have otherwise received free and reduced priced meals if they were in school, that we can provide basically a daily allotment that would take the place of that meal that they would have been provided. So it's similar to kind of how food share is provided. It can be used like food share benefits, but it's different from food share. So what where the, I would say, complication comes in is that this is only allowable for the times that children are not learning in person. And so we're gathering information on kind of how schools have been working throughout the pandemic, you know, what their school learning models are looking like, so that we can kind of provide that information and help to calculate benefits for families. We will be going all the way back to the beginning of the school year. So once those benefits come in, I believe right now the daily rate is around $5.70. But there's also some, I believe President Biden also signed an executive order looking to increase that allotment. And so we're also talking to Food and Nutrition Services about how that might be added into the benefits moving forward.
Rebecca, thank you for joining us. Mm-hmm. Rebecca McAtee is director of the Department of Health Services Bureau of Eligibility and Enrollment Policy, which runs the state's food share program. Stay with us as we discuss how lower than normal student loan applications may indicate lower than expected fall college enrollment. Have you completed your FAFSA in the pandemic? That's the form students fill out to get Pell Grants, student loans, other types of financial aid. Could you get the help you needed with FAFSA questions? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.